You're listening to Bedroom Beethovens, where notable music makers break down stories accompanied by songs and melodies documenting growth through their 10,000-hour journey. And me? Well, my name is Cello, your host.
It's the Bedroom Beethoven Podcast.
Whoa, you just blew my mind because nobody talks about that shit.
Thank you for this. Like, I was looking forward to this chat, man. I love your interviews.
I thank you for what you're doing. Like, it's excellent. And people can continue to learn the stories of these bedroom Beethovens.
How did you find out about this? Oh my God.
Having something like this to shed light on us is amazing. Like, we really need this documentation. So people like you are definitely needed.
Yo, yo, yo. Welcome. Episode 59 of the podcast is here. My guest this week has become a staple in playlists worldwide. Follow me as I head to LA, where the weather is beautiful and the sounds of the future are being synthesized. My guest this week is...
I go by Pat Locke, and I'm a dance, house, disco producer, DJ, musician. I have been on tour all over Europe with like Galantis, toured with Magician, more electronic soul groups like Han. I just finished my first residency in Seoul, South Korea last year. I don't know if that... I didn't really prepare my elevator pitch today.
Gonna take a break from showcasing hip-hop, and that doesn't mean we won't get live. Let's say you're in a new part of the world and you're in the club drinking your hand, music is pumping, putting the moves on a cutie at the club is tricky business. You want to look like you're into it, but not too into it. You need a groove that's funky but sexy, effortlessly cool, and Pat Locke music is your ace in the hole. We're going to dive into his 10,000-hour journey, traveling from Vancouver's Chinatown to globetrotting around the world. Part of the 5-7 Collective, the boss man being J57, who is always generous sharing his music with the show. Please take time out to rate this podcast on Apple Podcasts, throw me a 5-star review, or head to the YouTube channel and subscribe. BedroomBeethovens.com is the website, and there are all the episodes, social media, and you can pick up a shirt. It's the hub. The one-stop shop. Last but not least, the show is a lot of work, and I try to keep it as ad-free as possible, so patreon.com/bedroombeethovens is the easiest, simplest, fastest way to support your boy. You can give as little as a buck, and I'd surely appreciate it, my friends. Enjoy the new singles, because mid-May you're going to get new Pat Locke, new music, new year. It's a great time to be alive. Let's get the episode rolling.
Well, thank you for being, you know, part of that OG. Like, I don't hear that too often, so I appreciate that.
Yeah, thanks for being here. And I really wanted to talk last week because I believe was it your grandfather that passed away not too long ago?
Yeah, 96. So, you know, good run, but we sort of had to, you know, take some time. I'm actually going to go fly back up there.
Yeah, I wanted to say sorry, and I wanted to offer up my condolences because I know he played a big part in your life, everything from culture to food to music. And, he used to take you to Chinatown, back in the day. But you know what? If you go to, like, TripAdvisor now, everyone tells you to stay away. They say, you know, go to Crystal Mall or Golden Village because it's gentrified and there's nothing left there that made it great.
Man, I appreciate that. Yeah, you're up on that. It's true. Vancouver's Chinatown was a big, you know, a big point of pride for a long time. And actually now every time I go back, it's like, whoa, I guess that's just the urban development, I mean, a time told tale. But Crystal Mall has actually, that's funny you mentioned, because my parents just put me on to some spots out there that I need to eat at that I have not been to yet, for like some laksa, some more like Singapore, Southeast Asian food, which is my family's from Singapore originally, so I'm always looking for that.
Yeah, I didn't know that, you know, I guess back when your grandfather and y'all visited, I mean, that's the second biggest Chinatown in the world behind San Francisco. It must have been like pretty cool back in the day.
That's right. I don't know how long it held on to that, but probably because that was, I mean, you know, if you've been to Vancouver, like Chinatown is just on the edge of downtown. It's a small downtown. So yeah, we would go down there all the time. I go with my grandma. I remember like checking out all the different like produce and seeing all the weird or weird to me at the time, you know, like vegetable stalls, and you have all the seafood out there. And yeah, it was definitely a big part of my childhood.
Yeah, it's no longer the blue collar backwater it was 20, 30 years ago. And also because my dumb, uncultured brain, I thought Canada was nothing but white people, but the Asian population is like 33%. So essentially one in every three people you see in Canada are going to be Asian.
Yeah, you know, Vancouver is really like, it feels like 50%, and in certain areas, definitely. If you're, where are you based?
I couldn't get further away from Canada. I'm in Texas.
Yeah, I mean, like Texas, I've got family in Texas. Actually, I know, like in Houston, there's like a lot of Asians. But yeah, Vancouver is like in my mind, 50%. If you especially include the suburbs, so grew up super multicultural, and not just Asians, but you know, people from all continents of the world.
Yeah, I asked my friend in Texas who used to live in Vancouver, and I was like, what's it like? What if you could sum it up? And he says, well, I think people are happy to meet you, but they don't want to know you. That's the best way I can sum it up.
I can't find fault with that, actually. It's it can be tough. It's tough not to crack. I think maybe like the weather, just like it being sort of gray and often rainy. Not so much cold, but just so it can be a little insular, although people are polite. So I think depending on where you're visiting from will, you know, affect how, if you're visiting from like the UK or Europe, I think Canadians across the board will almost seem warmer than many places. So yes, perspective, but it's funny. It kind of like gave me these rose tinted glasses to see the world in, but now I'm realizing like how good it was or how spoiled I was, you know, growing up in Van.
What about like representation? Like, you know, you're growing up there, you're playing the bars and clubs. This is before Steve Aoki or Henry Fong or Spaz Kid, I imagine. So you don't see too many Asian kids doing what you were doing in that area at that time.
Yeah, I guess that's probably, I mean, there's, because I started back when I was in college, and DJs were the ones that I knew or had met. They were definitely still doing like, I guess, Final Scratch, like the early beginning of Throttle was just coming around, but then a lot of guys were running the CDJ thing, like on the electronic side, and some guys were still doing vinyl. I think it was still relatively niche, you know, it didn't like blow up big mainstream, and so there wasn't much of a, I didn't feel like, oh, this is all like one way. I mean, there weren't a lot of females. There were a few. I think that's probably improved, although, you know, there's that's another story entirely, like in terms of, you know, the accessibility and how the culture's opened up. But yeah, I guess there were a couple of other Asian DJs in town that I could remember, some like house guys and some more open format guys.
So this was kind of like, I guess, the time when like bands like Madison Avenue were big. That's kind of like the time you started paying attention to your craft.
Yeah, that sounds, I think that's probably around when I started learning or listening to house music without even really knowing what it was. And then, it was sort of that like mid-2000s boom of all those, like it was like Michael Gray, The Weeknd, and sort of big anthem. And I was listening to, I found out that I could stream the P-Tong's Essential Mix every Saturday from like midnight to 2 a.m.
Move the house.
break the house down. And that was, you know, just like it opened up the world to me of like, you know, all these like white labels and all these, you know, these streams. Sometimes they would do it from like a club or a festival or something. And that to me like represented the pinnacle of what was happening in the world, that it was really difficult or was unavailable in Vancouver at the time. I mean, I think there was like one club that started playing house music on the weekend. And I remember thinking like, yeah, like that's about it. Like it's not gonna, I don't know how how far this can grow in this market. Clearly I was wrong.
Well, I mean, let's define this thing. So correct me if I'm wrong on any of this, but EDM is basically the commercial dance music side of electronic music, whereas electronic music includes house, dubstep, techno, down-tempo. What else am I missing? Like trip-hop. So there's a lot of various subgenres under the electronic music umbrella.
Sure, yeah. EDM, I don't know what, like, when, you know, you could pinpoint. You know, that's probably what, late 2000s. I mean, if I'm not a historian by any means, but I mean, I would say, you know, with advent like Skrillex on the one side, you see that whole dubstep thing. You know, that was when EDM and Aoki kind of like becoming massive was like. So I don't remember EDM being thrown around as a term during even like the Bloghouse, you know, Chromeo, A-Track, Justice. Like that wasn't really a word yet. It was still like electronic music or. Some people that even liked it would still call it techno. You know, I mean, that was like, what was the thing? Be like, oh, you only play techno? I used to get that from people for like whenever they found out I was a DJ for like so long. And I was like, do you mean like to dance music or whatever, right? If you're talking about electronic music, that's essentially anything that came after a lot of the stuff that came out of disco, right? You went to like the birth of like acid house and techno, like in the US and in the UK kind of simultaneously in. Mid to late 80s.
Yeah, I think people are going to say the origin was like Mr. Fingers, Can You Feel It, or like Theo Parrish. And before that, house music was more industrial, more post-human sounding, more machine-like. And I think Mr. Fingers like introduced a more lush, soulful sound, and it kind of evolved from there. So that was Chicago or Detroit, no matter where you're from.
Yeah, I actually got to see him. I played a festival in New York that... it starts with an F. It's like F. I want to say Firefest, but not Firefest.
Oh no! Yeah, that's legendary. Before you moved to Cali, you wrote Fearless, and honestly, I mean Canada for California. I mean, starting over in a new country to chase a dream—that's heavy.
I had this beat, and just wanted to do something positive. I think that, you know, since I was sort of my introduction to a lot of house music was all that classic stuff. It, you know, it really had a message, and I wasn't feeling that, you know, that's maybe what people could use out there, and like something with a really clear, strong, uplifting sort of message, and sort of like a monologue or an argument I'm having with myself is sort of the context of that song, Fearless.
Yeah, Moby said that New York is the most amazing place to be drunk. Everyone's out till 5 a.m. It's the perfect hotbed for electronic music. So did you wrestle with where you would have located? Like, what were you going, like, maybe I should go to the East Coast, maybe I should go to the West Coast? Was there, like, a wrestle with that in your head?
You know, that's funny. I love New York. I mean, not that many people won't agree with that statement, but I understand why they might not. I think that the way the city's laid out, you know, you can just take this, you know, just walk or, you know, take the subway or whatever and get to wherever you need to go really quickly. And I would have liked to go to New York, but I think just with the amount of people I was working with in LA, so many producers and not even producers. I haven't really worked with producers that much, but more in terms of artists and songwriters. Have been coming out to LA. And so after doing some sessions down here, it seemed like the obvious move. Also, I just, it's a bit closer to home, to Vancouver, obviously. And then I play a lot on the West Coast, probably a bit more than the East Coast right now. So yeah, it was kind of all those factors. And then obviously it's a bit it's a bit more affordable than New York as well.
Do you remember how it felt when you got a reaction in terms of people actually dancing? It must have been just a wash of euphoria.
I remember the first LA show, the first couple of LA shows I did. One was at the Ace, and that was before My Own Throne. I mean, I was so excited to be, you know, on this popping spot. It was like in between both weekends of Coachella, New York, first good New York gig. I mean, just the clubs that you can play all these different. I played like some smaller shows. My goal, you know, when I started out, I was like, oh, maybe like one day you get a residency in like your hometown. And then you're like, well, maybe I could like go to another city and play like, you know, within your province or state or whatever. And then you're like, maybe it isn't one. Then you play, you know, in Seattle or something. You're like, oh, cool. Like maybe one day I can play in one of these, you know, massive centers of, you know, dance culture, like in LA or New York, whatever. Then, you know, like maybe, I mean, like the first time I went to Japan, I was playing in Tokyo, and like I was so like it took me a while to process it because I never thought that I would ever get to do something like that. And so you just sort of like gotta take the moment and appreciate it, and then you go sort of recalibrate and go like, well, you know, set your sights higher and keep chasing it.
Well, as you travel the world and you're releasing a lot of music, there's obviously a Patlok brand. So I'm hearing the news this week that Corona, the beer, lost $152 million in revenue since the coronavirus outbreaks. If 40% of Americans wouldn't buy Corona beer because of the coronavirus, I imagine how many Americans are racist against Asian people because of the coronavirus too. And it's all about fear and ignorance. And as history has painfully shown time and time again, before I segue into music, I just want to say, I hope you aren't experiencing any of this blowback. I hope you're being safe, and I hope all is well.
Thanks, man. Likewise. No, I think that when I'm here, I'm mostly a homebody anyways. So for health and for, I don't know, minimize your contact with other people, it's hard to get. But no, like I agree with you. My cousin posted something on Facebook. She lives in the Midwest, and she's like her kid, like her son's in like little. He's like, I should know this, but he's like 6 or 7, or he had been like, you know, the victim of, yeah, bullying because of all this stuff. This was just a couple weeks ago, and it's just like I feel for the people out there that have to deal with it. You know, obviously, like your Chinatown's getting hit. You can't see the future, but it's going to be a telling year or so in how this plays out. I mean, I guess all we can do is sort of stay positive and continue to, you know, support each other. And, you know, I think a message of positivity, like, I know I'm like harping on that, but, and it's not, that's not naturally how I am. Like, I'm a pretty, not pessimistic person, but like, I'm fairly critical of stuff. And like, I'm a bit of a skeptic, but I do believe in the power of like your mentality. And so, you know, I think that will go a long way in, you know, how we deal with this asset. I mean, right now it's kind of chaos out there. Like, who knows how this will hold up like a month or 6 months from now. So you've already seen like the Costco's and Walmart's are all like barren. I think that, you know, even in tough times, like all you really have is your mentality. I think that's something that, you know, my family, my grandfather, and, you know, the people in my life have sort of passed down to me. You control what you can control, and, you know,
the bullying and the violence is bred from fear and ignorance. So, I mean, I couldn't have said it better myself. So, you know, with that said, you know, I'm glad you're okay. And to kind of segue, you kind of came about with this kind of explosion in technology where suddenly you could DJ with a little box that you could put away in a drawer at home when you weren't using it. And I mean, a couple of turntables and homemade equipment back in the days when you really had to put 5 years of hard spinning to even understand what all this stuff did and so on. And now there's a different problem that people in 5 minutes can do what took you in 5 years to master. So we kind of moved into this space of trying to teach people the different ways and trying to teach people the important things, because it's not immediately obvious when you get a core piece of software in a little box. So there is this whole new generation coming. Some of them live in countries where they aren't in a position where they've got access to the best equipment or the best clubs or buying records. So now DJs are kind of become far more global, far more democratized. So anyone with a passion of music, it's now open to you. And I see you doing these splice packs and, you know, kind of putting your samples out in the world? Are you the type of producer and DJ who always wanted to be in touch with the next generation?
Passing it on, and, you know, or paying it back, or however you want to call it. That's definitely a part of, so I'm a bit of a hoops fanatic, and I actually like, I mean, I used to coach, I coached for a few years, like high school and junior high, both women or girls and boys. And, you know, it was just one of those things that, you know, in a past life, I think that, you know, not coming from a place of, well, I think that dissemination of the things that you learn, because it takes so long to accumulate. And I get why people, you know, dedicate their lives to it. I wanted to be a teacher when I was in school. That was what I had been studying for before. You know, I wasn't super applying myself in school, but which is kind of ironic. With that being said, I think that with technology, as you put it, is, you know, just democratization of all of these tools has made it a very exciting time that most artists now are not as elusive and mysterious as you had. You know, if you go back to like your Bowies and or your Daft Punks or your Prince and stuff, and there's still space for people like that who are incredible and kind of come from this other plane. But the world that I sort of grew up in is like, you know, you're a person figuring it out, you're building a community. But you're not thinking about, like, I've never really thought about it as building a community, even though that's definitely a good lens to put on it. But yeah, with like things like Splice, you know, sharing knowledge, and there's some tools and resources in place that I definitely wish I had at the beginning. I mean, I'm really thankful to be in this time, because if I was in, you know, let's say we grew up in the, if I was this age in the 90s or the 80s, my only chance would be to, you know, find someone with a, you know, reel to reel and start chopping things up, or try and sneak into a studio, or be an intern first and then hopefully work my way up. And that would be a slow, slow grind. There's like the new, there's always a new wave, and there's like what's cool and fresh. And that's exciting. At the same time, sometimes people will forget, young artists or producers will forget to, you know, do their homework and look at some of what has sort of really made its mark on time, like in the musical landscape. So the last couple of years, less so this year, but I was, you know, listening to a lot of like classic, like more than ever, like just you know, there's so many amazing songwriters over the last, let's just say like 50 years. And it's like, there's so much to take away from that, especially when you move from production into, you know, learning more songwriting and arrangement, that I feel like, you know, it's really now about prioritizing, you know, what am I going to learn? Do I want to work on how to make my drum sound tight right now? Or do I want to learn about arrangement? Like how to use a bridge, and when you might use, I don't know, a key change or something. Like what did Anita Baker do? What did like Carole King do? You know, things like that. How did James Jamerson play the bass? And how can, you know, I learn from that? And I think so that's sort of like the happy medium that I personally am sort of trying to always pursue. And then if I get to do fun stuff like these Splice packs and hopefully help or inspire someone in the next wave, then all the better.
Yeah, because that's the biggest revolution, right? How easy it is to gain access to the music. I type in PATL into Spotify, it autofills, and boom, your entire catalog's in my face.
Right. Right. It's scary times if you really, because it became so easy to release music. I mean, I almost feel that I wish I'd like held off with certain things, and even like records that I'd done that have been received pretty well. For example, the song Hollywood. I heard you ran away to Hollywood. I got cold feet about both of those. I was thinking about dropping one, if not both, of those tracks from the record. In retrospect, I'm glad I didn't. But, you know, it's tough when you're in the fog of it to know, you know, if it's like meeting all of your standards artistically sometimes.
Well, I mean, you had a song like Somebody that was a monster hit, but it was going to get axed too.
Yeah, that was a tough. We had to switch up like the vocalist at the last second, but yeah, that was like, that almost didn't come out when it did. And then I would have, you know, I might have got lost in the shuffle. You never know with these things.
I guess I was asking in terms of like when a song is finished, let's say you like it and you've been working for 10 hours and you're burnt out, but everyone is high-fiving at 2 a.m. and you wake up the next morning, you hit play and you realize at the minute 34 mark, you could have did something to improve it. So is there like a devil on your shoulder saying, hey, just turn it in? And maybe the angel saying, hey, let's rewind, let's embrace the stumbling point and make this song better. We're not done.
Yeah, I think recognizing those two voices is the, and that's something you kind of get only used to over time with experience. Then you start to understand like who's talking at what time. And, you know, like if a fill, you know, or just like a snare is bugging me, I had this a couple days ago with a remix and I was like, oh, like this is like bugging me, or this guitar is poking out. And I listened to on a couple different, you know, I listened to my phone and I listened to my computer versus, you know, just getting out of the studio, adding some different context to it. You know, some things you're going to fix and some things you're like, okay, no, you're just nitpicking. It's important to have that really high standard. But then also if you're making, we're talking about club records or, you know, songs you can play out, and seeing that reaction goes a really, really long way. Because if you play a demo out, I played a demo of my next single, Free Fall. I played a demo at Brooklyn Mirage, which is like 2,000 people a few months ago. I was like, I don't know how it sounds on a big system. Like, I think it sounds okay. And you had a lot of work still to do. And it went and got a great reaction. And I was like, okay, cool. Like this, I'm onto something here. I just got to, you know, continue to work on the final 10% of the details, but the concept is there and people are down with it. So that can really help push you over the top. I mean, if you don't have, you know, whatever shows of that scale, I mean, even if you're playing at small shows and, you know, a basement party or whatever, house party or whatever, I think that also goes a long way too. I remember My Own Throne. It was a really early demo. I played it at my very first Splash House and it got a great reaction. And then I played it, I think my first time playing at Sound in LA. And the security guy for like the VIP area came over and asked me in the middle of like the song what it was. And I was like, okay, well, maybe I'm onto something here.
Yeah, I mean, you're listening to the masters off of your next record. And I think you said that it sounds like nothing else that you've put out. And I mean, if I'm going through the Rolodex of kind of this genre, I feel like Moby riding electronica's coattails in the United States with the growing mainstream popularity of artists like the Prodigy, Chemical Brothers, I don't know, Daft Punk, Portishead, all of these acts infused music with their samples. So Prodigy were fond of speeding up old reggae tunes. Chemical Brothers favored hip hop. Daft Punk borrowed from disco and R&B, and Portishead kind of took cues from lounge and library records. What would you like? I mean, I've heard everything from Street Fighter flips, your love for Idina Howard. There's Tribe Called Quest. What would you kind of describe this new EP? Or maybe we don't even have to do the EP, just maybe a couple singles. How would you describe it if you could?
That's a great question. I'd say that I had a visual concept for the EP before I knew what the records were going to be on it and before I actually wrote some of a lot of the songs. So that informed, it's funny that you started off our conversation talking about Chinatown, but I'm sort of pulling on some of these old stories, influences that I grew up with, without giving too much away, created this, built this world or reshaped it into something, you know, of my choosing. And you know, we're going to do, you know, I'm really excited to share this when the time, which will be fairly soon, but I sort of built and wrote the record based around that. So I had some of these song ideas, but then sonically I wanted to, you know, I wanted it to reflect the visual concept, essentially this film concept that I had. So I would say that, you know, this, for this EP, it feels different to me. Because it's not as if it's just one, it's not just like a house, although it's definitely housier, more clubby than I have been doing. That doesn't say that much because I've, you know, put out like 95 BPM like hip hop tracks and stuff. But so there's that lens sonically. Still has some of the songwriting that I've been sort of refining the past couple of years. And at the same time, it basically soundtracks this film. So I don't know, I'm being a bit like opaque right now, but the influences come from kind of my own upbringing, and I feel it means a lot to me. Obviously, my grandfather passed, but he was the person that like showed me a lot of these stories and like, you know, watch these shows and read these books together when I was little. So I'm really excited about that. So that's, I would say that kind of informs this whole record. And that'll become more obvious once we start dropping some of the clips. You won't have to guess what I'm talking about.
Yeah, it's just you make music in this very fickle genre, like Thurston Moore from Sonic Youth. I think in a couple years ago, he said that electronic music was a brain dead exercise in plastic sound. While Calvin Harris is making music with Pharrell and Frank Ocean, making millions and millions and millions of dollars. So it's you have just a lot of toxicity, and I love to see just your music. I heard the EP, so it's not so vague to me. And what I want to say is your work with Thandi Phoenix. And I'm not going to just say this just because you're in front of me, but it's some of the best work from you that I've heard. And Phoenix has been making music for about 5-6 years, but it was only just recent that, and hearing the music, that we saw this journey of self-awareness come to fruition, where you're getting the best versions of people at their peak. Her vocals are really powerful. The chords and instruments are more considered, and the overall approach is just a little bit more self-assured. So I listened to it, and I do think it's some of your best work yet.
Thank you. Yeah, Thandi's amazing. I was able to do a day writing with her back when I lived in Mar Vista, and shortly after that, so we hit it off that day. We wrote the song, and it was initially going to be on this like different sort of almost like a tropical dance hall vibe. And that sat for a second. Then, like a couple weeks later, we were both playing in Austin at South By, and I saw her perform her single with Rudimental. This is just like a drum and bass single, but it's a, you know, great. You can see the potential like there. Basically, you know, it was becoming realized, and so I'm really excited to, you know, to have this song with her. And I'm actually should be heading to Australia fairly soon, so hopefully we'll get to perform it live, and that would be really exciting, because I agree with you, she's like she's a hitter, and the world is just, you know, finding out about her now.
Well, before you go globetrotting and before I wrap up this interview, I want to ask, because I'm getting a little peek into your mind, when you make music, do you expect people to pay attention? Because some people operate within the psychology that, hey, I make music because I like making music, and if it sells well or people pay attention, it's a nice surprise. But how do you operate? Do you make this music to get it out into as many ears as possible? Is that kind of what you want to do?
I'd say that's a bit of a big question, because that you're sort of lens on who the audience. I think to say that you're going to ignore whoever's receiving it on their side would be a bit of a lie for most people. I mean, I don't think that Chic wrote their hits. You know, if you read Miles' autobiography, they had a formula. Like him and Bernard Edwards, they were like, this is what a Chic record is going to be. He literally calls it a formula and is like, cool. I mean, reading that does not make me feel any differently about Chic. I still think, you know, like, gods, you know, like, if they figured out the formula, great, because we all benefited from it. So with that being said, when I'm putting together a record, I think when I'm writing to sort of visualize, either I'm inspired by something or I'm just writing as an exercise to try, you know, whether, you know, it's an aesthetic or like just a catch a vibe, or to use a, you know, terrible cliche. But, you know, then when you start putting together the record, like, you know, whether it's a single or an EP or something, then you're thinking, well, what am I trying to say here? I'm really fortunate that I've got a small platform And I've been able to put out, you know, these records, and a lot of them have been received by people pretty well, because there's definitely lots of producers who more hardworking and more talented that don't get that chance. So I would say that my goal now is to kind of just continue to say what I have to say. And if people come along for the ride, cool. Like if they don't, then, you know, that's okay too. But as long as I manage to fulfill my artistic vision each time out with each record, single, EP, album, that's got to be good enough for me on the music side.
Hey, I like that. And if you'll let me, man, let me do all the heavy lifting for you from here, man. Everyone go to patlockmusic.com. He's got shirts. He's got a takeout pin, which is real because he loves white rice. He's all over social media. Just search for Pat Lock. And what's really cool is, so this podcast is going to go out a couple days after Free Fall, and he's going to treat you guys, you know, up until the EP once a month, probably mid-month, I think April 17th. A new single from the EP will come out, and then you get the full EP in mid-May. And I know the name of the EP. I'm not sure if I'm supposed to say it.
We can bleep it out if we have to. I don't know what.
The greatest perk of doing this podcast isn't the sponsorships and the notoriety. It's being able to interview artists that I genuinely love. And man, I get snapshots into music early that people don't get to. And so don't take it from me, because I'm not a paid hired goon. It's amazing, and you guys are in for a treat. So Pat, if I missed anything, feel free to plug more stuff. But you know, it was a pleasure having you here, and good luck with 2020. Thanks, man.
Likewise, man. Stay safe out there. I really appreciate you taking the time. It's been a nice chat.